This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com and, of course, on the air right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And immigration is in the spotlight. Everyone's talking about it. Just a week or so ago, we had a big immigration rally downtown, and we have lots of studies and paperwork that you can read on BGov about it. In fact, Caroline Civello, managing analyst with Bloomberg Government, has recently written one that I found interesting, Highly Skilled Visa Supply, a BGov analysis, and Caroline's here with me now. Hello.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for stopping by. So let's talk visas. This is an area that I never really paid a whole lot of attention to, I'm going to admit. So after reading this, I felt really enlightened, but I got some questions. Let's talk about this H-1B visa. That's the primary method that companies are using to bring in this highly skilled workforce, correct?
Well, yeah, you're right. This is a really highly demanded visa for U.S. businesses and also some international businesses, as I'm sure we'll talk about. It was introduced in 1997 to address what was then perceived as a talent gap in the U.S. economy, basically not enough high-skilled workers to fill these jobs.
This is kind of used in conjunction with a resident visa? Are these employees who get these H-1B visas expected to become legal citizens, or how does this work?
Well, not necessarily. So this visa has a provision in it that a couple of other visas do as well called dual intent, which is basically while I'm here on this temporary non-immigrant H-1B visa, I can also be sponsored by my employer for a green card for permanent residence. But it's not a requirement. I can choose to stay or my employer can choose to sponsor me or not.
Sponsorship is done by the employer. What is the application period? How long does it take? How many of these? There's a good question. How many of these visas are out there?
Great question. And this is actually the crux of the H-1B debate.
Okay.
Currently, the cap is set at 65,000 just as a baseline. And then there's a separate pool of 20,000 visas for advanced degree holders. So this is for anyone with a master's degree or above. So altogether, about 85,000. And that's really what businesses are kind of clamoring over.
One of the startling facts that I found out here in this analysis that you wrote has to do with the time at which it takes for these visas to be snapped up. Most recently, just a few days?
Yeah, this year's visa supply went basically in the blink of an eye, 5 days from start to finish. And really, there's an 18-month application period, but based on the U.S. economy year to year, the demand fluctuates from a few days as this past year, which actually just closed a few weeks ago, to, 300-plus days in some other years.
All right, so 65,000 plus 20,000 for people with advanced degrees. Were these numbers just ripped out of the air? Is this an arbitrary number? Can it grow? Will it shrink? Is it going to ebb and flow with the economy?
Another great question, and also, again, what businesses are really trying to accomplish with this comprehensive immigration overhaul. Seems like it was somewhat arbitrarily set. Congress determines the number year to year. It has been higher. So back from, I think it was 2001 to 2003, the cap was actually at 195,000. And demand didn't even meet the cap in those years. They then lowered it to 65,000 with this extra 20, and it hasn't really shifted since 2005 at those numbers. Doesn't change based on demand. It's just a cap that's been set, and that's what businesses want to change.
So 100,000, 65,000, whatever the number may be, that's a number of jobs that people who are born and raised here in the U.S. will not be getting. Are people saying that they don't believe the skill set exists in the U.S. and that's why they're looking overseas, or it just so happens that...
Yeah. There's a lot of debate around this.
So,
on the one hand, there is a pretty low unemployment rate in a lot of these fields that these H-1B workers occupy. A lot of them are computer related. There was a hearing yesterday on the Hill, and I believe that someone quoted a statistic of an under 3% unemployment rate in those fields. And in some areas around Seattle, for instance, the unemployment rate is actually like 1% or so. So theoretically, there aren't too many American workers who are being excluded from these jobs. On the other side, though, of the debate are a lot of people who allege that essentially the H-1B workers are lower wage employees for a lot of these firms. They're highly skilled, but you know, the quote is indentured servitude. Again, that
I'll
was
bring you to the promised land, but you're going to work for nothing.
Exactly. And again, that was the other side of the debate in yesterday's hearing, and sort of why this issue isn't easily resolved.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My guest right now is BGov analyst Caroline Civello, whose latest analysis, that is, Highly Skilled Visa Supply, discusses the H-1B visa for just that, highly skilled workers. Something that I found interesting, as we talk about U.S. jobs, the percentage of companies that are not based in the U.S. that are getting these visas for their employees?
It's very high. So among the top 20 employers, which is included in this BGov analysis, 40% of the demand is from U.S.-based companies. So there's a lot of Indian-domiciled companies, Infosys, Tata, Accenture even is a non-U.S.-based company, and they actually get a lot of the demand of these visas every year.
I've dealt with just about every company that's on the list and had no idea that they weren't based in the U.S. Infosys, I had no idea they were based in India.
Yeah, and they have large workforces in the U.S., but the companies, parent companies are domiciled externally. And these are really the companies, I think, that are under the target of certain members of Congress. And these names popped up from Senator Durbin and others.
So as we take a look at the list here, obviously we got some big names on this list. There's a phrase out there known as hurt filioma. You know, oh, are you suffering from hurt filioma? Are any of these companies suffering from that hurt filioma where they feel as though they're not getting, if these visas are being snatched up that quickly, are they getting their fair share?
I think a lot of them would say they aren't. So Google, for instance, back in, I think it was 2008, said that 30% of their applicants for H-1B visas were rejected. And they've been really calling for a higher cap overall. I think there's a perception as well that a lot of the top companies on this list really dominate the supply every year. Mm-hmm. And again, a lot of them being non-U.S. based companies, it raises questions from the U.S. companies.
We're already just looking at 2013 petitions, 69,743 total, just from the top 20, companies. And Google itself, 650 initial petitions, 507 renewals with 1,157 total positions alone. One would say, well, you've got a healthy workforce there. Are the technology jobs just not overseas, or where people see the bastion of hope being the U.S.?
There are a couple of reasons for this. So one is, you know, 650 initial H-1B workers as a percentage of Google's entire workforce
Understood.
Is quite small. On the flip side, though, a company like our number one company on this past year's list, Cognizant Technology Solutions, they requested over 9,000 initial petitions for fiscal 2013. And that's a large percentage, I believe, of their U.S. workforce, most likely. Their total worldwide workforce is around 156,000 workers. Of their U.S.-based employees, that actually might be a big share, and that's also something that the Comprehensive Immigration Bill is trying to address.
What's next?
So a lot of these issues that we've already talked
right.
about. So for one, there's going to be a question about what the cap really should be. Because of the way that the petition process works, there's really no good estimate of what the true demand is. Really the best proxy, as we discussed earlier, is this sort of year-to-year change in how quickly the cap is met. But because the application period is shut off as soon as the cap is met, sort of the rest of that demand just never registers.
Right.
No one ever counts it. So there's questions about what's the right level. There's questions about does it need to adjust year to year? And then there's questions of, you know, should there be some new limitations on this program? Should non-U.S.-based companies be treated differently than U.S.-based ones? Should people whose workforces are really majority comprised of H-1B workers be treated differently as well? And what should the protections be for U.S. workers?
Her name is Caroline Civello. She's managing analyst with Bloomberg Government. Make sure you check out Highly Skilled Visa Supply. It's on BGov now. Caroline, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Alan.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, and there's always a topic that can get the hair on my arms to stand up, and that has to do with cybersecurity, especially the way the United States and the president are taking this voluntary approach to protection and compliance, especially in the private sector. So they don't roll that way overseas, you see. In fact, overseas, they impose some new requirements and some costs on those private companies. Here to discuss the cybersecurity divide are Bloomberg Government analysts Sanford Reback and Alan Holmes. Gentlemen, how are you?
We're great.
Why is it that we always seem to be number two with regard to cybersecurity?
I'm not sure we're number two here, actually. I think some would argue that in some ways the U.S. right at this point is actually ahead of the Europeans. What the Europeans have done is they've taken a mandatory approach. The U.S. is really looking at this and saying we need to be led in the solutions by the private sector. And that, to my mind, actually has some validity to it. This is, you know, technology changes very quickly. Cybersecurity is very complex. You don't want the government to come down with standards that are going to be out of date before they're published. So the notion of being led by the private sector is probably not a bad idea in some ways.
The U.S. Has the approach that they think that, you know, they view technology as changing so rapidly that they think that any type of regulation would be outdated and actually may even hurt security. But, you know, You do have the other side to argue, and that's what the EU's taking.
Give you an example here, if taken directly from the cybersecurity divide. This order from the president explicitly forbids the Department of Homeland Security from classifying any commercial information technology products or consumer information technology services as critical infrastructure. We're talking Google's Gmail, Apple's iCloud. On the other side of the coin, also on the other side of the pond, oddly enough, they do include internet search engines such as Google, social networks as Facebook, LinkedIn, e-commerce platforms such as eBay, and application stores such as those from Apple and Android, among others. Why are we not protecting these when we live with them?
Well, that's a very good question.
I'm pointing my finger at you, Alan Holmes, because it's your fault.
Basically, you know, that's AT&T and Verizon's argument, and some other companies are saying, hey, wait a minute, isn't Microsoft's Windows platform critical infrastructure? I mean, they have a large market share. We do know there are holes in that. That's how you can get into networks as well. It's a very valid argument and something that has been pointed out. Why it's there, you can take the typical Washington cynical viewpoint and maybe saying that they had some access to when this executive order was written, mm-hmm. or you can say that they really truly do believe that it's not critical infrastructure. But when you have so many people using these platforms and that they can be used to get into systems, I think it's a valid argument that the EU has that this is critical infrastructure.
I guess what the Europeans would probably say is that this is the cybersecurity is only as good as the weakest link. Mm-hmm. So if you've got the network secure, you know, you've got the phone lines and the lines that carry internet information secure, but don't have the applications that run on top of that secure, someone's going to come in through your Hotmail or someone's going to come in through your Gmail. Now, on the other hand, the Europeans, maybe they go a little bit overboard. They are looking at things like...
Sandy, you can't go overboard.
You said that was allowed on this. But I thought on cybersecurity, you know, you still could go over it, but they're looking at things like Expedia.com as being subject to this. And is that the right kind of company and application to put out as a first go? I think you could have a reasonable discussion on that, and certainly the United States is not taking that tack right now.
Let's take a look at the private companies that are based overseas or have offices overseas versus here in the U.S. There's going to be obviously a difference in the amount of money that needs to be spent to secure a U.S.-based company versus an overseas or European-based company.
It really doesn't matter where you're based, actually. I mean, the way the European proposal would work is if you offer services within Europe, you're going to have to comply with whatever legislation they come up with. So if you're based in Cupertino, California, mm-hmm. and you offer services to European users, at least for those users, you're going to have to comply with whatever they come up with. So where you're based is not going to make all that much difference in the end. I think an interesting question to see. Cybersecurity can't be controlled by the Americans or the Europeans alone. Presumably, they have to work with themselves and the Japanese and others to figure out a system that actually works here. And if you've got one major player like the United States going a voluntary route and another major player like the Europeans going for a kind of a regulatory or mandatory route, how are they going to come together and actually cooperate in this area? It's a big question.
What we're pointing out, that Sandy and I are pointing out here, is that this is setting up a point where it's going to be somewhat of a friction between the U.S. and the EU, because they got to iron out these differences.
And consistent standards.
Right.
By the way, you're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're talking about cybersecurity and the cybersecurity divide specifically. My guests right now are Bloomberg Government analyst Sanford Reback and Alan Holmes. Alan spelled incorrectly, by the way. A-L-L-A-N.
No, you spell it incorrectly.
Whatever. We'll agree to disagree. This is a topic that's very near and dear to my heart with regard to cybersecurity. I have had my email hacked. This is more than just that. We're talking, you know, search engines, e-commerce. You guys have put a table in here with a number of companies that could be affected by the European Union legislation. These are little companies like Apple, Spotify, Sony's PlayStation. I don't know about you, but my Call of Duty saved stuff is pretty important to me.
That's critical infrastructure.
That's critical infrastructure. I've been planning stuff in there for a while. It's not easy to get as far as I've gotten.
Right.
Who is the United States going to follow? Will they take the European Union's approach and say, well, those things are looking, well, let's you guys do that? Or are they just going to say, you know, figure it out yourselves?
Well, they've been doing, each side has been doing a little bit of both, quite honestly. The United States has said, you know, we're cooperating and talking very closely with the Europeans, and we certainly have the same goals and objectives. And the Europeans are careful to say, you know, we're requiring that you secure your critical infrastructure, but we're not going to be the ones who are putting out standards. That's going to be kind of the even in Europe, it's going to be the companies coming together, working with a standard-setting body to come up with the right standards. So right now, at least, they're trying to paper over their differences. But when you've got a system where Amazon might be subject to something that's voluntary in the United States, but have actual legal ramifications, fines, if they're not complying in Europe, those are two very different systems, and it just remains to be seen. It doesn't seem like the Europeans are going to come down off a more mandatory approach at this point. They've been working. They've said specifically when they proposed this legislation, look, we've tried voluntary stuff for years and it hasn't worked. We've got 27 countries that are members of the European Union. We got some countries that are taking this really seriously. We got other countries that aren't really paying it the time of day at all. And we really need to lay out something that's going to at least bring everybody up to a minimum level. So, you know, given that, it doesn't seem like they're going to fall off at all. And on the other hand, we've got a very motivated private sector here that doesn't want the government to put its toe into internet regulation too much.
Yeah, and on the U.S. side, DHS will determine what is the critical infrastructure. That's what they're going through the process right now. And then also they believe that in the information sharing, it's voluntary, but you'll actually want to be a part of that. But it's going to be a market-based approach, which means you're going to some companies going to have to step up, probably an ISP, Internet Service Provider, like Verizon, AT&T, that provides this service that they charge for. Now, some people may think that this price is too high. Some people may think that, well, yeah, I'll go ahead and buy it. But it's not going to be 100%. And whereas in the EU, it will have to be if you're considered critical infrastructure to take part in this. So there will be holes left in the U.S. Approach. It's right now just all being formed. NIST is putting together its cybersecurity framework, which is they're not really standards, but you know, there's something that you should at least follow these voluntarily. Mm-hmm. But it does leave open, the executive order does leave open the possibility of it being mandatory later on. But that would have to be something that would have to go through Congress.
That's a good point, Alan, and that's what I was going to add. I think that one of the reasons that we don't have mandatory standards now is that you couldn't get that through Congress. Even if President Obama wanted to do that, and it's not clear to me necessarily that he wants to do that, but even if he and the administration wanted to do that, I don't think at this point there's any way that mandatory requirements would get through this Congress. Now, maybe it'll take a big cybersecurity incident. Maybe it'll take people losing a lot of money through one of the major banks, or the an energy grid going down somewhere because of a cyber attack to get people, or to see, you know, stocks decline because of something like that. Then maybe you've got a better chance of that. But right now, there doesn't seem to be any appetite on the Hill to get any of this stuff through in a mandatory fashion, at least in the U.S.
At what point, like you just said, will it take us to go, all right, we need to react? Why can't we be proactive about this? The European Union, yes, is being proactive, yet locked in to some agreements or some requirements that everyone is going to live by and live by that minimum standard only because that's all they're required to do. But in the U.S., this open door, I don't know. I think the president needs to step up and actually, although, like you said, nothing's going to get through this Congress. A budget, nothing, right. nothing's going to happen. Yeah. So it may take another few more years before something happens or that horrible infrastructure crash that's going to cause someone to go, we need to fix this.
I think this really goes to a difference in philosophy between the Europeans and Americans and how they view business and how they view government. We've got a fundamental mistrust in some ways of a strong federal structure, and you still hear those arguments, very legitimate on both liberal and conservative sides about how much power the federal government should have. And we really place more faith in the private sector. In Europe, it's probably the opposite. They really are suspicious of companies. Mm-hmm. They don't have the same faith in what I would call unvarnished free market capitalism maybe that we have here. They have more protections for workers. They have higher labor standards, all those kinds of things, even than the U.S. does. And I think you're seeing some of that fundamental differences in philosophy unveil themselves in how the two sides are looking at cybersecurity right now.
Gentlemen, what do we need to look out for next?
There's kind of two schools of thought. One, I think what will cause Congress to act, and this has been said by many other people, it's somewhat of a cliche now, but it's an electronic Pearl Harbor. It's going to take something where people actually lose their lives. But that's what some people have said, and there might be some truth to that. But what the people that right now that are attacking these systems that they want to keep them open. They don't want to create a catastrophe. They want to continue to get the information coming off. They don't want to kill the goose that's laying the golden egg for them, which is stealing the IP or doing something for intelligence. So they don't want us to get really tight on network security. And sometimes we don't even know they're there. So will something really catastrophic happen? Maybe when a terrorist group or some other group that's more interested in harming U.S. interests gain the skill set to do this. They're not there yet, at least from what I hear. But also, in just looking forward a little bit more, one point that Sandy and I made in the report is that the EU is positioning itself to be a fairly hardline negotiator, and in their proposal they actually say they need to get quote unquote our own house in order, and saying that we need to get our cybersecurity rules and regs set up, get our computers secure, so that, and let me quote, to extend its international reach, it being the EU, and become an even more credible partner for cooperation at bilateral and multilateral levels. They realize that if they get this through, they're in a more powerful position. They can put more leverage on the U.S. to improve its situation as well as other countries. And I think that's what you're going to see down the line. At least that's what the EU sees what's coming.
We got to step back a little bit and be a little careful here. When you think of the big internet companies, the ones that have really changed the ways that we live today, you know, think of Amazon, think of Facebook, think of Twitter, think of Google. Last I checked, none of those were European companies. They're all in the United States, and it says something about the vibrancy of how our economy works, and that's something that I think people are legitimately concerned about. Now, what's interesting here is you basically got the same companies on both sides of the Atlantic fighting just with different governmental authorities. They're fighting in Washington to keep it as voluntary as possible, and they're doing more or less the same thing in the EU. And it really, I think, is going to be kind of this tripartite negotiation down the line. You're going to have this set of private sector actors, and then you're going to have U.S. authorities who are more sympathetic. You're going to have European authorities who are less sympathetic, and they're going to have to reach some kind of common ground. But I really think we're probably looking at, I'd say, several years before all this is wrapped up in a bow. And because, as we talked about, nothing's static in this. Once we think we've got this problem nailed down, maybe a couple years in advance, something's going to happen. We're going to be starting the conversation all over again.
Right. Sanford Reback, Alan Holmes, gentlemen, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, Alan. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.